About a month ago, Elon Musk changed priorities for SpaceX and for the Starship. Plans have changed. They are no longer going to Mars. He is now focused on building a city on the moon. And this made a lot more sense to me and a lot of other people in this space because the moon is very close and it's much more accessible. But as part of this conversation, he also rolled out his plans for building AI data centers in space as the next logical step. And then as the next step after that is to build AI data centers on the surface of the moon and then launch them off the surface of the moon with mass drivers. And the response was skepticism, me for sure, but also the response here on YouTube is very loudly skeptical. There's a lot of reasons why space-based data centers don't make sense. You've got the problems of thermodynamics, the amount of heat that's being generated. You've got challenges of being in a space environment. You've just got the ludicrous costs of launching things into space when you can build them down on the surface of the Earth. And I was sort of ready to fall in line with the rest of people who sort of see this as like a ridiculous idea and perhaps a distraction from sort of the larger issues that are going on in the AI world and the sort of future plans for various companies under Musk's leadership. But I read a blog post from a friend of mine and it sort of got me thinking a little more deeply and I did a little bit more research as well. So today I'm talking to Dr. Casey Hanmer, who I have interviewed several times in the past. Dr. Casey Hanmer is the founder of Terraform Industries. They're working on some pretty cool technology that will essentially extract carbon out of the air and turn it into synthetic fuel. And theoretically, they're trying to make it so it's cheaper to just make fuel out of the air than to extract it from the earth. And then that will become sort of another renewable resource. He has a PhD in theoretical physics. He was an engineer at NASA working for 4 years at JPL as a software systems architect. He has sort of helped me understand that asteroid mining, space power, cities on the moon, that there's no incentive for any of this stuff to work. But according to Casey, there are reasons why AI data centers in space might not be completely infeasible and practical, and that this could be a ladder up to that solar system spanning civilization that science fiction has led us to believe. So enjoy this conversation with Dr. Casey Hanmer. Casey, it's good to see you again.
You too.
So you are my bellwether for space ideas that sound good on paper and maybe have a storied history in science fiction, but are ridiculous on the face of it. And you have, sort of extracted all of the oxygen out of the idea of asteroid mining in my mind. You've done the same with space-based power. You have done the same thing to colonizing Mars, the moon. You have very efficiently sort of helped me become more of what I believe to be a space realist. And so after we got the big announcement from Elon Musk saying that he was planning on transitioning SpaceX and now they're going to launch AI satellites and this is going to be the next big thing, I was immediately incredibly skeptical. And then I saw you posted a blog on the subject. It was something like, I guess we're playing Factorio on the moon now. And I figured, okay, great. This is going to be a sarcastic response from Casey. I read your blog and you were not entirely immediately dismissive of the idea, which that alone was enough for me to reach out and go, what? And in conjunction with what has been the absolute negative response to this by many, many people on the internet and especially here on YouTube. So square the circle for me.
Yeah, well, I'm glad to be everyone's favorite buzzkill. That the idea of doing more edge compute in space has been around for a long time. It never really passed the sniff test for me because, if you're concerned about power consumption and thermals and maintenance and so on, it just makes more sense to put the compute on the ground and then shoot it up into space and back down again via Starlink if you have to have some space involvement in it. That basically remains my point of view today. There are, however, a couple of exceptions, which in SpaceX's usual way, I expect them to exploit. And the first is, if you have effectively a monopoly on good value launch, you spent 20 years building this unique launch and reuse capability, then you don't get hit quite as hard on launch costs, right? And if you already have your Starlink satellite mass production facility up and running, you don't get hit quite as hard in standing up your satellite mass production. There are a number of other kind of things which can help there. And so the question comes down to, is the production of tokens for AI inference something which is commodified to the point where there's no real money on the table? And I think that if anything, NVIDIA's results today should tell you the answer to that is no. This is a market where we're fundamentally constrained on production, not on consumption. That AI tokens are extremely valuable to the people who are purchasing them. They regard them as a bargain. And that actually means that, you know, instead of this being a highly verticalized industry, like say launch, where the margins are kind of razor thin and often negative, this is actually has the potential to be a pretty horizontalized industry with, you know, four or five or six different layers, each of them making good money. So you've got TSMC and NVIDIA making money over on the chips. You've got Starlink, making money on the satellite integration, and then the end user ends up making a lot of money, right? The AI tokens are an essential part of whatever their business is, but it's not particularly expensive. It kind of goes into the same category as, you know, electricity price, keeping the lights on, you know, maintaining parking spaces or something like that. It's a cost, but maybe not the major cost of operating a particular business. And that means that it doesn't actually matter that much if it costs Starlink twice as much to serve a token as, you know, the cheapest bargain basement ground-based data center, because they're generating, you know, 100x value, right? So it trims their margins a little bit, but that doesn't matter. If they're profitable, they're profitable. And that actually kind of draws us to the major reason for SpaceX to do this, right? Why bother, right? Which is that they're on the cusp of finally delivering the Starship launch capacity. And, you know, years ago, I would have said, well, it doesn't matter how many Falcons they build and launch, they'll never be able to saturate the market for space-based internet. And I think that's true, but Starship is on another level, and Starship launches, you know, 10 or 20 launches a year would be enough to completely replace the existing Starlink constellation and then maintain it indefinitely, or upgrade it substantially. And so you really kind of need a soft landing for this massive increase in launch capacity. I mean, SpaceX talks about 1 million tons a year to low Earth orbit. And the nice thing about compute is that it's that, right? As long as it's profitable, then you're in business, right? Part of the reason why I think it kind of makes sense to do this is that in general, if you're doing stuff in space, you pay per kilogram, and GPUs are extremely valuable on a per kilogram basis. So the launch cost of a GPU is actually not that high. Even when you roll in the ancillary costs of satellite structure and solar arrays and so on, it ends up still being a pretty good deal. Like, it turns out that a GPU in your backyard versus down the road versus in space, it's all pretty much the same cost, just because the GPU is so dominant in terms of that overall cost. So overall, as you said at the beginning, I think the way to think about this is pretty much all satellite businesses come down to trading, you know, microwave transmitted bits for money, and you want those bits to be valuable enough to pay for the fairly substantial cost of running a satellite. And we know already that Starlink is extremely profitable. They're bringing in something like $10 billion this year. So in order to believe that AI compute in space for SpaceX, who has all these different advantages, would not be profitable, you'd have to somehow think that the marginal value of a bit of or that transmits an AI token is less than the incremental cost increase to slap some GPUs on the side of a Starlink satellite and send it up there. And I think that's a pretty weak argument. I think that actually, the future is unwritten, but there's a good chance that SpaceX will end up making enormous amounts of money on this. The one kind of other major aspect of this that will come up probably in the next few minutes when we talk about moon stuff is that power costs are proving to be problematic for AI data center development here on Earth, not on a per kilowatt basis, but on a lead time and acquisitions basis. And the advantage of building satellites is that you only have to deal with one regulatory regime once, and then you can spam the satellites into the sky sort of indefinitely. Whereas every single AI data center is its own unique special snowflake that, you know, has to be carefully shepherded through many, many layers of regulatory and approval and permitting authorities, which, yeah, look at my gray hairs, is an incredibly tiresome and taxing process, even if you have, you know, the resources and the urgency that the AI data centers have. It's still almost impossible to get this stuff built on Earth. And so we may see a future in the next few years where the, you know, elasticity of supply of land to develop solar or otherwise powered AI data centers here on Earth just kind of goes vertical. And as a result, you know, basically space is the only place where you can, you know, at a fixed marginal cost, continue to add compute. That would be a very interesting future and a good one for SpaceX and the shareholders and employees, I think.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's interesting to me the response that people have given to this and, you know, and I want to sort of address all of these elephants in the room first before we move on to the moon. But you know, thermodynamics and bit flips from cosmic rays and all these kinds of things, right? There's a bunch of concerns, the price, it's on. But I mean, I think that we are rushing headlong into a bunch of issues like climate change and degradation of land and loss of diversification and habitat and all of these things. Some of them are overblown. Others are maybe even bigger problems than we have sort of the media is leading us to believe. And that even if the costs were higher, if we can get this off planet, it feels like there are advantages there just for us to let Earth do what Earth is supposed to do, which is be a great place for life and push that heavy industry off planet. And so I think that, you know, in the same way that even if, say, solar power was more expensive, which it isn't, or hydropower was more expensive than coal or whatever, that we should still pay that money to do that.
Yeah. I mean, there's a couple of points there. The first is, it's all very well to kind of agree on behalf of your fellow, you know, citizens that it's worthwhile to pay incrementally higher energy costs in order to uphold certain aesthetic preferences regarding the environment. But these are costs that actually get borne by your children and grandchildren as well as by you. So you have to be a little bit careful about how far you go down that road. The second thing I would add is that for the sort of land where you and I want to deploy solar to power data centers, the solar is actually a net add to the environment. It's certainly the case that if you're logging old growth Brazilian rainforest or something to put down solar panels, that's a net negative on the environment. But for, you know, much of the undeveloped southwest desert of the United States, putting up shade structures of any kind is good for the handful of creatures and plants that live there. In terms of total biomass and you know, actually like reversing desertification, I think that the actual species that stands to benefit the most from establishing at least competitiveness, if not the superiority of space-based compute, is humans. Because it's already quite obvious that the acre of land under solar powering an AI data center is, you know, 100 to 1,000 times higher economic productivity than an acre of land, you know, growing wheat or soy or corn to feed you. Which means that if we end up living in a world in which there's unlimited increased demand for AI compute over the next how many years, decades, and that there is no escape valve, there is no ability to move AI compute off world, that our food is just going to get extremely expensive, right? And that's, you know, and to the limit where essentially humans are starved in preference to generating electricity for the non carbon-based life forms that will then dominate the world. And you know, in terms of like AI doom scenarios, that one seems the most likely to me. So that's kind of the general point there. But you know, general, like the thing that's stopping us from deploying solar at, you know, multiple terawatt scale here in the United States is actually like kind of a where we've gotten 50-year-old environmental aesthetic preference about, you know, whether or not you're allowed to put up new chemical plants or oil refineries. Which is completely blind to the fact that solar is actually a net positive to desert environments.
And I mean, Technology Connections did a great video sort of on this. I don't know if you saw his video, but the gist being that when you look at the amount of land that's just set aside for making, say, corn-based ethanol, you could just turn that into solar panels and just solve all energy problems in the United States overnight.
Exactly.
That's the level of efficiency. And at this point, really, you have to hate money to not go with some kind of renewable energy project compared to coal. God, right.
Yeah.
Well, we're going to come back around this because I do want to talk about sort of some of your sort of thoughts on this, because that's your day job really is working on technology and solutions for climate change. So we'll come back around and talk about that. But I want to address the kind of the elephants in the room and, you know, you already sort of said this sort of like the why, which is, you know, people have done the math on putting a data center in space. And they're looking at it from this sort of like a megawatt data center that you may put into orbit, that the size of the radiators, the thermodynamics of this are impossible. And yet, you know, we don't see extensive cooling systems on Starlink satellites. There is clearly ways around this. So can we kind of address just the thermodynamics of heat in, heat out first?
The solar array itself in space is sitting in the sun, and only 25% or so of the energy that hits it gets converted into electricity and moves down the wires to some other part of the satellite. And the rest just gets converted into heat right there, and yet it doesn't melt. So just like sitting in the sun won't make you melt. It'll make you warm until you're radiating heat at the same rate that you're absorbing it. And so really the challenge for AI data centers in space is that a lot of that energy is going into the relatively small GPU die itself, and then has to be, you know, extracted from there with a typically a liquid cooling system, and then spread out to a wider area where it can then radiate again. But, you know, there's 50 different ways of solving this problem, and pretty much all of them are fungible in launch mass. And launch mass is a problem that is, you know, definitely within SpaceX's wheelhouse to solve. So yeah, I mean, I can spend a pleasant afternoon with a whiteboard, like devising more and more devilishly clever ways to deal with the heat. But at the end of the day, you can just brute force the problem. It doesn't particularly matter, provided that, you know, you're doing it on a GPU by GPU basis. And so I think like one architecture that might make sense is you have your solar wings, right? A solar wing is composed of a series of modules that are initially all folded up, and each wing can have its own captive GPU and radiator, right? And so the heat generation is just kind of spread out along the size of this wing, and it can be 20 kilowatts or 50 kilowatts, whatever makes sense from a packaging perspective. And then the only thing that the satellite bus per se has to manage is, you know, a local area network with, you know, either hardwired fiber or even, you know, Wi-Fi basically. And then the much more powerful antennas, which actually do have a fairly substantial thermal overhead themselves, to transmit and receive data from Earth or from other satellites, or doing so via laser links as well. So you could actually imagine like a relatively small set of structural changes between current Starlink satellites or Starlink version 3 satellites, and one that would be capable of, you know, spending 90% of its energy budget on GPU calculation. And then of course you say, well, you know, if the GPU gets fried somehow, you know, you can't replace it. Well, sure you can't, but you know, that particular panel of the solar wing will no longer be functional. But most of the cost was the GPU anyway, right? So it just sits there and the rest of them continue functioning. And after 5 or 10 years, you deorbit it and start again. Yeah, I mean, like the expensive thing about a GPU failing in a ground-based data center is you have to have some poor schmuck like walk through the data center and pull it out and put a new one in. Or you have to like purchase a new GPU. That's like I think I've made my point there.
Yeah. But I mean, I guess my sort of interpretation of this is that if you're just launching a single GPU with solar panel to power that GPU and the bare minimum, say a laser link that allows it to send its data to some other node on the network, it's a fairly small, bordering on CubeSat device that the radiative issue is not that bad for that single GPU. And then you could, for example, put 1,000 of them in a Starship and spit them all out and they would just be orbiting, free orbiting. Or as you said, you can connect them together into larger groups that will, you know, they can save costs on propulsion or orientation because they just need one set of thrusters to orient the entire group or whatever. Like someone has already done the math. Like, you know, people at Google, people at SpaceX have done the math to find out whether or not, and there's been plenty of papers that have done the math. And then the same thing with the bit flip idea that, they're going to get hit by cosmic rays. It's going to kill some of the GPUs, but they merely spent $100,000 on it, right?
Yeah. I mean, it may be the case that by cost, your space-based data center is still 80% GPU, of which 40% of that is margin going to NVIDIA, right? So like, you know, can't get too sad about it. As far as bit flips go, I mean, Elon has remarked, and I think he's correct here, that neural network computations are actually pretty robust to noise. It's certainly the case for our own neural networks, which are almost entirely noise. The pure logic, you know, there's a if then else, whatever logic that maintains regular computer programs is much more vulnerable to, like, you know, a switching branch at some point. But if it's just giant piles of matrices being multiplied together and added up, it doesn't matter that much if you throw a bit of noise on top.
And you sort of suggested, like, maybe what they'll do is they'll just throw an extra GPU on every Starlink that they launch from here on out, and they'll just test out this idea and see where it goes, and that there's sort of
roughly
value.
One per panel. Yeah. So if you've got, like, your standard, I mean, the ones in satellites are a different size, but, like, your standard solar module is about, you know, 2.2 by 1.1 meters, and it's like a, you know, modern tatami, right, as a standardized rectangle. In space, you know, one of those will receive, I think, like, 2.5-3 kilowatts of power, from which they'll generate, you know, 600 watts of electricity, 700 watts of electricity. And your GPU is consuming about 700 watts of electricity at peak. So you'll actually have, like, one GPU plus one radiator module per solar module. And so you may have 20 or 50 solar modules per satellite. And that's kind of how that'll get racked up and sent out. That's how I'm thinking about it right now. But of course, you could do it other ways. I think the key thing is you probably shouldn't put all the GPUs in, like, one module, right? And then have, like, a square kilometer solar array pumping all this energy and heat into, like, this one module that then has to have, you know, burn 20 PhDs worth of work on refrigeration engineering just to keep it cool. Like, why do that? There's no reason to put them all together in one place. You may as well spread them out.
And so your original point in your blog, and we'll link to the blog, was that it's in the value of the bits that, you know, one of the reasons that Starlink has, as you said, you know, has made whatever it is, $10 billion, you know, we don't know until they really go public, that the value of the communication from the Starlink network is lower cost per bit in terms of transmission than building the equivalent ground-based cell tower network. And so it is a competitive solution to that problem. But is there the same kind of economies of scale for AI data centers?
Yeah, I mean, it comes down to what the world turns out to be like in terms of how hard it is to build another 100 gigawatts or 1,000 gigawatts of solar here on the Earth, or, you know, how quickly gas turbine manufacturers can spool up, if that makes sense. We don't really know the answer to that. But if you're SpaceX, you know, you have a number of extremely large hammers at your disposal that almost no one else has access to. And so these various problems start to look like nails that you can smash. As far as the value of the bits, I've got a spreadsheet floating around. People have seen it. It seems to me that it will always be about, you know, at least twice as cheap to produce your AI tokens on the ground as in space. But it doesn't matter all that much if your revenue is 50 times higher, right? Like, you take a tiny hit. Take a tiny hit on production cost, but you're still making a lot of money. And as far as Starship is concerned, right? The problem with Starship is, like, there's a giant program that'll just burn, you know, a couple of $1 billion a year just in running costs, right? Just in operating costs. And so if you're able to have an internal customer for that capability as you scale it up, that is even just breaking even, right? Just breaking even, then you're not losing money on having the giant Starship capacity. And if you're making money, that's great. So the bar for business success for the Starship style Think, I guess, or Starlink AI combo doesn't lose money as quickly as either would by itself. Whereas the competitors on the ground, the hyperscales and so on, that they actually want to show, like, decent returns on capital and have their stock prices go up and so on. So I think all in all, I would definitely not bet against SpaceX being able to make money on this.
Right. So the scenario on why you do this, I mean, that spreadsheet that you mentioned, that sounds great, right? That it will always be about twice as expensive. Financially,
at
you
best.
Will never.
I mean, if you are a third party,
at best,
right? Like the OneWeb equivalent of this or something.
Yeah,
it could easily be 100 times as expensive.
Right. 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 If you own the whole stack, at best, it's still twice the cost to do your AI in space. But you can imagine a scenario where, for example, the energy, because there are so many AI data centers and there's so much power flowing into them, it's causing electricity prices to spike because the solar panels are lagging. People are getting increasingly uncomfortable with them spinning up more gas turbines. Canada refuses to transmit hydroelectric energy to the US. The costs come up, and at a certain point, SpaceX just says, this is our relief valve.
Yeah.
Let's just launch these things into space.
Well, hydro is pretty relevant, really, in the scale of what we're talking here, right? I mean, again, Elon is not wrong when he says that all the marginal growth will come from solar. Right. So really what it comes down to is making a bet as to, you know, how difficult it will be to permit hundreds of gigawatt scale solar farms in the United States per year. And if past history is anything to go by, it will be stupidly pathologically difficult to do that. It does not guarantee that at some point, you know, the dam won't burst. In terms of raw capacity, you know, in the Southwest United States, there's room for millions of gigawatts, which just kind of underscores the futility and stupidity of this whole argument anyway. And you're like, oh no, we might, like, worst comes to worst, put a bunch of like low impact shade up on 0.1% of our desert. And everyone's getting like, you know, twisted out of shape about that. But yeah, I think SpaceX and the Elon cinematic universe in general would know as much about the difficulties of permitting real world stuff in the real world in the United States as anyone would, given that a lot of kind of the new industrial stack seems to depend on that.
Right. But I guess for the people that are playing at home and they're sort of watching the economy evolve, if they're seeing their electricity prices go up, then this is making a stronger and stronger case for parties like SpaceX or maybe Blue Origin to start launching AI data centers into space. That would be one of the outcomes, is that math is working more and more in the favor of that being the solution, because you just can't build them at the same kind of cost on the ground.
I feel like the power prices going up as a result of consumers competing with AI data centers for power is like, it's a very short-term problem. Because if we're talking about a future where we're talking like hundreds of gigawatts of solar deployment to power AI data centers, then like the United States is finally going to get its hundreds of gigawatts of solar farms up and running. And the AI data centers uptime requirements are much more stringent than like your regular utility. And so they'll just be like, everyone will be awash in spare leftover power. In which case, you know, I'm not saying that consumers' electricity prices won't continue to go up, but they won't be going up because of lack of supply. They'll be going up because of lack of competition in distribution and transmission, right? And getting the power from your local, hyperscaler, which has its own captive solar battery power plant, 5 miles down the road to your town. And is it beyond the capacity of the Tennessee Valley Authority or PJM or PG&E or whoever else to like find some way to spend billions of dollars moving that much free power down the road? Of course it's within their capacity. They have a long and storied history of screwing up that badly. But that's not the fault of the AI hyperscalers.
No, I understand that, but it feels like, you know, I think when people see Elon Musk say that this is what's going to happen next for SpaceX, and as you said, the Elon cinematic universe, which I think is such a great, I'm going to steal that. That is so good. That he's making it sound like this is a good idea. And what you're telling me makes it sort of feel like mega corporations that are making trillions of dollars in this new technology, if it actually pans out, are going to come up with even like elaborately complicated solutions to make more money hand over fist. And one of those might be, let's just put these things into space.
I mean, I don't really have a problem with corporations making surplus value for the economy. Yeah, like no one is forced to transact with Google, right? I am forced to transact with the IRS, but I'm not forced to transact with Google. Like the fact that Google is wildly profitable just speaks to the incredible value they've unlocked in terms of like efficiency of advertising primarily, but also, you know, the value of the services that we use to communicate every day. And that pretty much goes for all of the like competitive modern tech companies. So, yeah, there's a few that have gone down the dark path of like trying to establish a kind of government protected monopoly with like mandatory people using them. So like if you think of like the tax preparation firms and stuff like that, right? Like there's definitely some involuntary association going on there on the part of their customers. But for the most part, like if Anthropic ends up making tens of billions of dollars because they figured out how to lever the entire global growth rate from 2% up to 3% per year, like that's a bargain for everyone involved, a massive bargain, right? Everyone is doing extremely well.
So let's shift gears then and talk about the second part of the Musk plan, which is to send these data centers to the moon or build them on the moon.
Build them on the moon. Yeah.
So, I mean, it's funny because if you sort of look back at the original O'Neill cylinder concept that was put together, this was their plan, was that they would build the, I guess, solar power collecting satellites on the moon and the raw material for the giant O'Neill cylinders. And then they would launch them via mass driver out into space and then collect them at the L4, L5 point to start to build humanity's future in space. So I guess for you, this had always felt kind of ridiculous.
Yeah. I mean, I did read The High Frontier and I quite enjoyed it. And I think it's a really interesting exploration of this technology, but what it lacks is a tenant. You know, like what it lacks is your tentpole customary economic engine that actually drives it forward. In the book, they say, well, we wave our hands a bit about electricity demand in the 1970s and hope for the best on that front. But actually, it's really interesting. Like the only thing you need to add to The High Frontier to make the economics go from like laughably inept to actually pretty strong is you say, what if instead of having to sell the microwaves that we produce in space at great expense to Earth for 10 cents a kilowatt hour, we can sell them for the equivalent of $10 million a kilowatt hour because those microwaves are not being used to transmit electricity to Earth, which is fundamentally silly. They're being used to transmit intelligence to Earth or even just internet data, right? Other humans' intelligence or you've got AI data centers in space. And suddenly it goes from being like, yeah, your margins are negative no matter which way you slice it, like not even close, by like a factor of a million, to actually, you could pretty much do this any way you can imagine, and you'll still be making, you know, massive margins. You're still like, even something as profligately expensive as building moon bases for the first time, you could still make money doing it because you're just unlocking so much value. I mean, it's the same kind of idea that like you drill a hole in your backyard in Saudi Arabia and out comes oil. And like, it doesn't require like some like incredibly advanced economic thinking to figure out like you're going to be rich. Does that make sense? Right. There are fabulous businesses out there you could just pick up off the ground.
Yeah, but I think you're going to need to break this down for me because it isn't like I get that the economics of the AI chips, like, for example, you want to go and you want to buy, say, a brand new NVIDIA H100. You're looking at, I don't know what they are, $100,000. I mean, you know, I've gone shopping for H100s recently,
a lot,
but
yeah,
they're a lot. Right. And yet they are sold out for years. The RAM that goes along with them is sold out for years. The hard drives that they use is sold out for years. Like to the point now that I just can't build a gaming PC for my kids. Yeah, I mean,
they're obviously underpriced.
Yeah, they're clearly underpriced and will probably continue to grow.
Well, so see, chips tend to go in a boom bust cycle, right? So you know, again, Elon has said, and I think he's probably right about this as well, which is that currently the supply of power outstrips chips, but it won't for much longer. And we're going to get a lot of very cheap memory on the market in a year or two. You know, unless we get a hard AI takeoff, which would be pretty good.
And bad.
Well, depends what the ultimate outcome is, but like, yeah. But economically speaking, right? Yeah. I think like the model you'd look to here is something like SpaceX is launching 50,000 starships a year from the Earth. And they're building and assembling the satellites and starships on the Earth in gigantic factories. Like they're already starting to build. They're launching 50,000 starships a year into orbit containing more AI data centers, but they're starting to run into a constraint in terms of launch capacity, right? And you have to think carefully, like what would that constraint be? It wouldn't be fuel, it wouldn't be rockets, because it's relatively easy to build fuel and rockets on the Earth. It might be something like just the sheer number of like rockets that you can re-enter into the atmosphere, something like that, right?
Right. I mean, even just like aluminum particulate from the satellites degrading and falling back into the atmosphere. I mean,
that's a solvable problem as well, right? You could just grab them and bring them back, right?
Right.
But you say, well, you know, we're running into constraints. So instead of launching the satellites all the way into space, what if we just launched like the really expensive part that's hard to make, the GPU, you know, kind of annex or mezzanine or whatever, and we'll try and build much of the dumb mass, the solar array, and the structure on the moon or in orbit around the moon using parts, raw material from the moon where you don't have that same constraint on launch up mass. But if you run the math on this and you say, well, 50,000 starships a year off Earth is 5 million tons or something. And so you say, well, we want to build a mass driver on the moon. Okay, cool. Sounds good to me. The mass driver has to be able to launch 5 million tons of material of either manufactured parts, which can tolerate the acceleration, or maybe like 20 million tons of raw material, which then gets processed into lunar orbit. it means you need extremely substantial energy generation capacity on the moon, right? So like, this is not something that's going to happen overnight. I'll put it that way. A bunch of different people, Phil Metzger, he's probably been on your show a few times. Tory Bruno, the late Paul Spoutis, and Jerry O'Neill, obviously talking about like the cislunar economy. It would have to have a tenant like this, right? It would have to have some economic engine it's somehow necessary to do it on the moon or in space. And also like throws off trillions and trillions and trillions of dollars a year of net economic value. And AI compute might be that, you know, it sure as hell isn't, you know, making rocket fuel on the lunar South Pole or something. That's for sure.
Right, right. And so one possible model for that is that they've launched a ring, say, of AI data centers that are following the moon in orbit around the Earth, or maybe they're all clustered around the L4, L5 points. You send them a crawl of the entire internet, and then they do inference on that or training on that for 6 months, and then they have the 200 gigabyte model that's done, and then they just send that thing back home to Earth, and all of that work was done out there in space at that incredibly competitive value. What would have been a $20 billion training run, a $50 billion training run, is now done out there in space.
I know it's far enough in the future that it might be worthwhile thinking about like what would an economy that's primarily run by and for AIs look like. I mean, you got agents interacting. Their unit of exchange would be tokens and of various grades. They wouldn't need money. They wouldn't need food. They would need power, right? So, I think you kind of get into the realm of sci-fi in that regard. But you know, one things you can do from the moon, for example, you say, well, like from Earth, you could probably saturate the sun synchronous orbit layers in the polar orbits of the Earth, right? With just Earth-based launch. So if you're launching from the moon, perhaps you're integrating in lunar orbit and then sending them off around the sun, right? And depending on what sort of AI they're doing, maybe latency isn't that important. I don't know. It's just, you can speculate. It seems a little far-fetched to me to jump all the way to the giant lunar factory from where we are today.
I mean, I when I think about sort of like the sci-fi dream, right, of having the solar system spanning civilization that we, as you said, you know, you have this anchor tenant that gets you to a reason, a purpose for starting to do that. And in your writing and in the writing of a lot of people that I really respect, that anchor tenant has never existed. That every possible justification and rationale for humanity going beyond low Earth orbit, geosynchronous orbit, really, is a money pit that you will just lose money until your company goes out of business.
Yeah, just to kind of make this clear, you need an industry that turns over ideally at least high tens of billions of dollars a year, right? At least with like significant growth upside on top of that. And that industry also has to deal in products where the cost per kilogram is, you know, maybe $1 million a kilogram or something like that, right? Expensive enough that the relative cost of transporting it by rocket doesn't matter all that much. And the really funny thing is that like, in terms of value density, like dollars per kilogram, GPUs and are that, and obviously radio messages don't have a mass. It appears that marginal demand for additional intelligent compute is essentially infinite. And I could imagine it remaining that way forever. So this could actually be it. Even if you happen to like go to the moon and stumble across like a perfect pile of diamonds or like a meteorite that was made of 100% palladium or some other absurdly expensive metal, even though the dollar cost per kilogram for those materials, a tiny handful of materials, is high enough, the total market size is too small, right? So there's basically nothing in that department of like very, very large industry in terms of total turnover and then very, very high value on a per kilogram basis, except for data products and then, you know, extremely bespoke computing systems. So it is kind of interesting to think about on that front.
Right. I mean, that, you know, if you're talking about whatever, 50,000 starship launches per year, like those will have consequences.
About one every 6 minutes or something.
Yeah, that will have consequences to planet Earth.
Well, you say that, but like the amount of fuel they carry is not significantly more than a large jet aircraft. And large airports will have an aircraft every 2 minutes. So like if you max out LAX, you're getting about 1,400 planes a day, right? Mm-hmm. And then we're saying like 50,000 rockets a year is a lot. It's not really, not on the scale of even global aviation today. So you have to look for some other constraint that you run up against. I don't know exactly what it would be.
Right. Like maybe exhaust gases going into the upper atmosphere, which is we're not doing right now.
Yeah, but it's going to be CO2 in water. It's not a particularly big deal.
And then as you said, you know, them burning up and going into the atmosphere is absolutely a downside. And, you know, people have set pretty hard limits on that. But as you said, if you can do it intelligently, you pick up all the satellites and bring them back home, then you can avoid that issue. Pick a higher orbit, whatever.
If you're launching from South Texas, right, and every single Starship that goes up comes back and lands, then you're going to be getting a sonic boom every 3 minutes. But if you're doing 50,000 launches a year from that one site,
right,
which would be because you get a sonic boom from the Starship and a sonic boom from the booster, which is a lot. But yeah, there are plenty of islands on Earth that are remote enough that you could launch and land from them and no one would even notice.
Right. So concentrate the sound effect into one. Yeah, small area. Sound.
Like you might see, you know, if you're using the South Kerguelen Islands or something, you might see the rockets re-entering over South Africa or something. You wouldn't hear them. So yeah, like these are all problems that are extremely solvable on the scale of like 50,000 launches a year. You're talking like an industry that's turning over $1 trillion a year or something. Like for $1 trillion a year, you can go and build a new launch platform and on a Pacific island or something. That's easy.
Mm-hmm. But so, I mean, it is interesting to me though, that kind of, I mean, well, Elon Musk said, you know, there's probably a limit. Like once we get beyond say 1,000 gigawatts of compute rollout here on the surface of the Earth, that's probably the practical limits that you would be doing. And then you'd be kind of forced to go to space. And these all sound like ludicrous numbers. And yet, I mean, Anthropic's run rate in profit is like 600% so far in the first few months of 2026. Like we're still seem to be in this really kind of bizarre fast takeoff. And I think everyone's waiting for the bubble to pop. I've been through tech related bubbles in the past. So I am absolutely bracing myself for that bubble to pop, and then I can pick up my H100 for dirt cheap on the, you know, on eBay, or pick up that. So all of that giant solar farm that was installed at now rock bottom prices. Do you think that, you know, when you sort of put on your sort of environmental side of things, you know, with the previous booms, the railway boom, we had all this excess built track that could then be used, bought at cheap prices, and that sort of created this burst in railways. For the internet, 2000, it was the installation of all the dark fiber that then has been providing capacity for decades ever since. Do you think it's energy this time around that you're going to get the solar panel installations of your dreams to feed the insatiable need for AI? The AI crash is going to happen, and now we're going to have a bunch of power with no home.
Yeah. I think that AI as an industry is not going to crash. I think that there'll definitely be winners and losers in terms of the current companies out there. But it's just, I mean, I don't know about you, but if you're a coder and if you've tried Claude Code recently or Codex 5.3 or something, like something changed in December. It's quite tangible. I'm
100%.
I'm a competent coder and quite good at math. And I don't think I will ever be doing my own math or my own code ever again. I've been like literally scraping through my archives of like old projects that I hung up because I just never had the time to do them. And I'm just like point Claude Code at an old Google Doc and be like, hey, can you make this work? And come back half an hour later and it's done.
Yeah.
I'm like, I'm going to run out of things to do in a couple of weeks. That's for like a couple hundred bucks a month. Like,
yeah, I don't want to stop you right there.
Give me entire years of my life back.
Yeah, yeah, I want to stop you right there because that is my exact experience, like 100%, that I had this list of someday maybe projects or stuff that I was just ill-equipped to be able to deal with it. And my someday maybe list has just been decimated. I just picked up a bunch of stepper motors and a Raspberry Pi, and I'm in the process of building a manual interface to my telescope mount so that it doesn't need a piece of control software, and I can run it exactly how I want to run it, doing plate solving on the sky to be able to orient the telescope and live stream it onto the internet. And I'm just like, okay, now move the motors, please. And then a second later, you know, the motors start to move, and I don't know how it did it. It's just doing it. So how should people, like, my audience is very scientifically knowledgeable. The sort of thermodynamic issues, the dangers of cosmic rays, the economic issues are all kind of front and center in mind. And it feels like there's been a lot of very skeptical channels that are just like, here's why this is such a dumb idea. You try and put a megawatt center in space, the thermals don't work, and that's ridiculous. So, and at the same time, I think there is this perspective that when Elon Musk says things, you take them with a grain of salt, that you put everything into sort of Elon Musk time, and you wait patiently for the flights to Mars that are seemingly never going to happen. And now plans have changed, now they've shifted. So how should people parse, not necessarily from what people say, because I don't think you want to listen to what they say. What should we parse by what actually happens? What kinds of things would give people a sense of what road we're actually going down?
That's a good question. I mean, in general, I found that market signals are generally pretty reliable. I think people have like a stated preference and a revealed preference, but what they actually spend their time on, what they actually spend their money on, they actually spend anything of theirs that is, you know, you can't spend it twice, is a pretty reliable predictor of what's actually going on. As far as Elon standard time goes, I think, like, I've never gone wrong by taking Elon at his word and interpreting what he says as literally as possible. I think where people get confused is where they say, oh, he couldn't possibly have meant the exact thing he said. He probably meant something a bit different. And then they're like, well, he said this thing, and then it didn't turn out to be true. And like, well, if in doubt, just be more literal.
He says we're going to launch a million AI satellites, and probably it's going to happen fast, probably by the end of the decade. That feels, I am skeptical.
Yeah, I think if it was anyone else, you'd feel skeptical. But at the same time, Tesla produces a million cars a year. So that's kind of the scale we're talking about. And he understands and has workforce that's already established that's able to do those sorts of processes. And then at the same time, when it comes to essentially like elbowing out the competition for access to launch slots and downlink capacity, there's no disincentive as far as dealing with the FCC to undersell the size of the constellation you plan on building. So you should pick a big number and do it, because you can build up to that number, but in practice it might be quite hard to go over. So, you know, we saw that already with Starlink, right? Starlink just went and acquired some like failing satellite company for billions of dollars just to get access to their spectrum.
But would we see, I mean, again, this kind of sounds almost a little ridiculous, but would we see Starlinks enhanced with H100s? Would we see, like, when starships are successfully launching, landing, getting refueled, launching again, we're starting to see that cadence, then that is demonstrating that the platform is going to be viable? Because, like, we have, you know, we haven't seen a landing on the moon yet, and Artemis 3 is waiting on this.
Yep. Yeah. But yeah, I mean, I think on the Starship side, there's a few necessary hurdles that have to be cleared. And I think on the satellite side, I'd be shocked if they hadn't already launched a GPU to get test data on the existing Starlink satellites. So I guess we'll find out.
Yeah. Now, okay, well, I'm going to ask you the question that I ask all my guests, and that is, what are you obsessed with right now?
Claude Code.
Me too.
Yeah. I'm going to finally finish my Mars mapping project. I did it old school manually for like 12 years, and I made a fair bit of progress, but I've been able to replicate all that progress and exceed it in like 1 week with Claude Code on top of a newborn baby and like six other things and running a company. So yeah, it's pretty outstanding. I can feel my intelligence ebbing away as yes. as the days go by. So
yeah, that's the downside. Cool. The downside is the price we're paying is we're losing our smarts.
Yeah, or maybe growing in a different direction.
Yeah, yeah.
I wrote a book last week with Claude Code. Like, just took a bunch of random notes I had and said, complete the research on this and put it all in order. And the 66,000 words out later came out. I was like, oh, that's deep.
Right. Yeah. You're going to need to do an edit pass on that.
Probably one. Yeah.
Yeah.
Use another agent. All right. It's been great.
But yeah. Well, if people want to track your work and you know, we didn't even talk about your company, but where should people go?
That's fine. I'm very active on X, and I run a company called Terraform Industries, making the synthetic fuel, and I'm hiring. So I should have said that up front and center, but I'm bad at this.
Right. No problem. I'll make a mention of it in the introduction. All right. Thanks, man.
Cheers, man.
I hope you enjoyed this conversation with Dr. Casey Hammer. Now, I have some very complicated thoughts about our conversation and about this sort of field in general, which I'm going to give you in a second. But first, I'd like to thank our patrons. Thanks to Abe Kingston, Andrea Pedretti, Barely Roofing, Brian Bodie, Caradwin, Chuck Hawkins, Commander Bielak, Cooper and Daly, Dark Finger, David Giltonen, David Matz, Evan.pro, Greg Feely, James Clark, Jeremy Manor, Jim Burke, Jordan Young, Josh Schultz, Marcel Smith, Michael Purcell, Nordspace, OneStepForAnimals.org, Parabuck, Renkaidu, Richard Williams, Sean Sargent, Stephen Fondamundi, Team 49, Telescopes Canada, Wolfgang Klotz, and Zeldabor Galactic Defender, who support us at the Master of the Universe level, and all our patrons. All your support means the universe to us. So I have complicated feelings about this situation right now, and I'm trying to sort of be in this information gathering phase where I am sort of open-minded and exploring what's possible. And I lived through the dot-com crash and experienced what it was like to be in the midst of a bubble. And it felt like a bubble, and I sold out of my company at exactly the right time so that I wasn't hit by it. But this feels similar. And yet, you know, the experience that I had talking with Casey about working with Claude Code, with developing software products, with sort of smashing through my backlog of projects, this does feel different. And yet, does it feel like gobble up the entire world economy different? Maybe? I don't know. It feels like we're moving towards a range of unpalatable choices where either it's a crash and it takes the economy with it, or it is wildly successful and destroys jobs or destroys humanity. And so we have to thread this needle in no matter what we do and come up with a solution that makes this technology work for us, work for humanity, get the job done. And because there's so much money being spent in this industry, hundreds of billions of dollars, it's going to be moving to trillions of dollars every year, it's really hard to rule out ideas. And I think we need to evaluate each one sort of based on its merits and watch as things are proceeding forward. And so hopefully this gives you another perspective. And you've got a lot of people that are just casually dismissing this as a terrible, crazy idea. And then you've got people who are kind of sycophantically following what Elon Musk has to say and like, yeah, whatever he says, it's going to happen. But I think there is a third path, one where you think about it carefully, consider it, watch as things are unfolding, get experience with how these things are changing our lives, and come up with a very kind of personal experience for how you think this is going to move forward. And, you know, I do think that it's going to have an impact. And I think the more we can learn about it and understand it, the better prepared we're going to be both individually and collectively as a society to deal with it. It is complicated and it's happening, and we don't know what the final ramifications are going to be. So maybe this is never going to happen. Maybe we're going to see data centers in space. Maybe we're going to see mass drivers on the moon. I don't know. We'll see what happens. All right. We'll see you next time.